I've been starting these sessions with prayers from Walter Brueggemann, an Old Testament professor from Atlanta, Georgia. And the ones I've picked previously have just been for, he always prays at the beginning of class, or he prays at the beginning of lectures that he delivers all over the country and all over the world. And he prays when he delivers a sermon in chapel at the seminary that he taught at. This one he actually wrote for Genesis 25 to 50, part of Jacob's story and Joseph's story. Come on in. So let us pray. We imagine ourselves self-sufficient, and then we run short. Short of time, short of life, short of stamina, short of newness. We find our future closed off and at risk. And we, with varying degrees of resolve and determination and panic and despair, find ourselves, surprisingly, back in your presence, waiting instead of acting, receiving instead of making, invited to gratitude instead of success. We wait and we receive and we thank because you are the only Lord of the future. You are the one who births at the 11th hour. You are the one who comes to barrenness and makes new. You promise like the stars for number, while we count according to the old math. You are out beyond us. We are staggered, stunned, awed. We did not know you had such futures in you, and now we know you do indeed. Amen. An editorial from the New York Times this summer reported, as it got to its editorializing, 30 countries have already seen food riots this year. The ever higher cost of food could push tens of millions of people into abject poverty and starvation. In the last year, the price of corn has risen 70%. Wheat 55%, rice 160%. The World Bank estimates that for a group of 41 poor countries, the combined shock of rising prices of food, oil, and other raw materials over the past 18 months will cost them between 3 and 10% of their annual economic output. Some of the causes are out of government's control, including the rising cost of energy and fertilizer, and drought in food exporters like Australia. Higher consumption of animal protein in China and India has also driven demand for feed grains. Wrong-headed policies among rich and poor nations are also playing a big role. Of those, perhaps the most wrong-headed are the tangle of subsidies, mandates, and tariffs to encourage the production of biofuels from crops in the United States and the European Union. According to the World Bank, almost all of the growth in global corn production from 2004 to 2007 was devoted to American ethanol production, pushing up corn and animal feed prices and prompting farmers to switch from other crops to corn. They did get to editorializing at the end there, but one thing that's happened in Mexico that you may remember is tortilla riots. The so-called tortilla riots of 2007, during which thousands took to the Mexico City streets to protest the rapidly rising cost of maize. And that's in large part on account of ethanol production. So here's a book review from the New York Times. The End of Food by Paul Roberts. Paul Roberts had written a prophetic and well-received book in 2004, The End of Oil, on the Edge of a Perilous New World, that anticipated the current energy crisis. Now he's moved on to what we put in our mouths. Roberts' new book, The End of Food, takes into account a vertiginous pile of recent developments. He foresees, or he tries to look ahead at the year 2022, when global warming and overpopulation have rendered the earth inhospitable to most plants and animals, And steak and strawberries are black market goods consumed only by the super rich. We've reached the end of the golden age of food, Roberts writes. No longer do the things we eat grow only more plentiful, more secure, more nutritious, and simply better with each passing year. Instead, E. coli outbreaks have almost become an annual autumn ritual, this year in the summertime, in fact. And a new day is arriving when cost and convenience are dominant. The social meal is obsolete, and the act of eating has devolved into an exercise in irritation, confusion, and guilt. Robert's worst-case scenario isn't tomatoes devoid of taste. It's a perfect storm of sequential or even simultaneous food-related calamities. Climate change and spiraling population growth have been wondering not just whether we'll be able to feed 9.5 billion people by 2070, but how long we can continue to meet the demands of the 6.5 billion alive today. Roberts delivers a litany of terrors, small and large. Arable land is growing scarcer. Inputs like pesticides and synthetic nitrogen fertilizers are increasingly expensive. Soil degradation and erosion from hyperintensive farming are costing millions of acres of farmland a year. Water supplies are being rapidly depleted in parts of the world, even as the rising price of petroleum, the lifeblood of industrial agriculture, is calling into question the entire agribusiness model. And we could say a lot more. You could say, yeah.
One of these wonderful Holden Village serendipity thing.
Yeah.
I happened to bring this book. When you started going through the issue, I flagged to one. So let me read this in relation to that. This has to do with U.S. foreign aid, specifically dealing with situations where there's a crisis situation, starvation. Some aspects of aid should be dead simple, such as fixing outmoded programs and policies that make no sense. During 2006, as much of the world went hungry, so it was before this, Cecilia Duggar of the New York Times nailed a boondoggle that has amazed foreign correspondents for a decade. That's called Public Law 480. It seemed like a no-brainer, Duggar wrote. Changing the law to allow the federal government to buy food in Africa for Africans facing starvation instead of paying enormous sums to ship it from the American heartland halfway around the world. Not only would the food get to the hungry in weeks instead of months, the government would save money and help African farmers at the same time. The Bush administration sponsored a bill in a Republican-favored Washington, departing from its go-it-alone policy. It sought to put America, by far the world's biggest food donor, in step with such rich countries as Canada. Congress stomped it to death. Public Law 480 is a political bargain that has underpinned U.S. aid for half a century. It insists that generosity to the world's hungry must also help, get this, it insists the generosity of the world's hungry must also help American agriculture. The law says that all official food aid must be grown by American farmers and mostly shipped on U.S. flagged vessels. Duggar puts it to the heart of why the bill died. Quote, the administration's proposal has run into opposition from three interests, some critics call the iron food triangle of food aid, agribusiness, the shipping industry, and this last one, charitable organizations. Just four companies and their subsidiaries, led by Archer, Daniels Midland, and Cargill, sold more than half of the $700 million in food commodities provided to the United States agencies for international development food aid program in 2004. Anyway, basically it says, BARTS shows the deep stake that nonprofit aid organizations have in maintaining the status quo.
Yeah, sure. They know how it works, they don't want chaos. I mean, it could get worse from their point of view. I'm sure that's part of it. Bread for the World tells us that the world hunger situation has improved in the past couple of decades. We've made some progress, but these are alarming new indicators that it could all fall apart and go in another direction quickly, and that it's happening. So I don't know if you have ideas about how we might solve the world food crisis, or if you have small places where you're trying to at least influence the system or make a difference. Let's look at Joseph facing a food crisis in Egypt. So we want to read chapter 41 today. And again, I'll be reading from Everett Fox, who translated the Old Testament, keeping as close to the rhythms and vocabulary of the Hebrew as he could. So it doesn't sound quite like your English translation there, which is Englishified. This is a Hebrewified, Hebraicized version of the Old Testament. Chapter 41. Now, I want to tell you that chapter 41 is part of that inner unit of the Joseph story, 39, 40, and 41, that tell about the foreign boy who gets brought under duress to the big cosmopolitan country of Egypt and makes good, rises through the ranks because he has wisdom, because God is with him, because he has something to offer. He can be trusted, he's loyal, and he makes good decisions. And unfortunately, at the end of chapter 40, he's still stuck in a pit, an Egyptian prison. Even though he showed his competence in the prison, somebody who worked for the Pharaoh, whom he assisted, who could have helped him, has forgotten all about him. But that is soon to change. Now, in the middle of these three chapters, this is it's a story that's kind of charmed by life in Egypt. Egypt is an exotic country. It's kind of like when I lived in Atlanta studying with Walter Brueggemann, the main theater in town had sort of an Arabian theme, and so there were stars in the sky over the seats in front of the stage, and there was like a bazaar in the background. It was all made of plaster rocks and stuff like that. It had tents and things like that. I think it was called the Baghdad Theater or something like that. There's this feeling about Egypt in these three chapters, and even though it's a Hebrew story told in Hebrew, there are some loan words from Egyptian in here. It would be like if I said to you, write a story that includes these French words, café au lait, double entendre, coup d'état, and esprit de corps. Well, you could go do it, and if you use that all within the space of the story, we would sort of think, someone who loves France. Well, in these chapters we have, especially in this chapter 41, we have people who are fascinated with Egypt. And so some of the Egyptian loan words in here, and we won't be able to tell this because they're English words in our version, but if you were reading Hebrew, these words would be Egyptian borrowed words. The Nile River, the name of the Nile. Soothsayers, rushes, the reeds at the edge of the water. Ring and fine linen, what Joseph is dressed in. There's an Egyptian word, abrek. We don't even know what it means. Maybe something like on your knees or attention that we'll come to. And then Joseph's name is changed to an Egyptian name. And his wife, he's given a wife who has also an Egyptian name. So all these things give a little exotic flavor to this chapter. As Joseph deals competently in a foreign world. And here he goes. We'll first start with 41, 1 through 8. These are the dreams of Pharaoh. Now, at the end of 2 years' time, it was that Pharaoh dreamt. Here he was standing by the Nile stream, and here, out of the Nile, 7 cows were coming up. Notice cows, they don't have those back home where Joseph comes from. They have sheep and goats. So cows are another Egyptian sort of thing. 7 cows were coming up, fair to look at and fat of flesh, and they grazed in the rushes. And here 7 other cows were coming up after them out of the Nile, ill to look at and lean of flesh, and they stood beside the other cows on the bank of the Nile, not eating. Then the cows ill to look at and lean of flesh ate up the seven cows fair to look at, the fat ones. Pharaoh awoke. He fell asleep and dreamt a second time. Here, 7 ears of grain were going up on a single stalk, fat and good. And here, 7 ears lean and scorched by the east wind were springing up after them. To the east of Egypt was desert, so the winds that came from that direction were parched and drying. Then the lean ears swallowed up the 7 ears fat and full. Pharaoh awoke, and here, it was a dream. But in the morning it was that his spirit was agitated. So he sent and had all of Egypt's magicians and all of its soothsayers called. Pharaoh recounted his dream to them, but no one could interpret them to Pharaoh. The empire is at a loss. The greatest ruling country in the area has run into a dead end. They don't have the knowledge, the insight, the technique, or the divine gift to figure out what these dreams might mean. Pharaoh is agitated, though. So now, verses 9 through 16. Joseph is called before Pharaoh. Finally, he's remembered by the cupbearer. Then the chief cupbearer spoke up to Pharaoh, saying, I must call my faults to mind today. Pharaoh was once infuriated with his servants and placed me in custody in the house of the chief guard, myself and the chief baker. And we dreamt a dream in a single night, I and he. We dreamt each man according to the interpretation of his dream. Now there was a Hebrew lad there with us, a servant of the chief of the guard. We recounted them to him, and he interpreted our dreams to us. For each man according to his dream he interpreted. And thus it was, as he interpreted to us, so it was. I was restored to my position, and he was hanged. Pharaoh sent and had Joseph called. They hurriedly brought him up out of the pit. He shaved, changed his clothes, and came before Pharaoh. Now, as a Hebrew, he didn't need to shave. Hebrews wore beards and long locks. But if he was going to appear before Pharaoh, he kind of wanted to look good on Egyptian terms, and so he shaved and cleaned up and put on new clothes. Also, he put on clothes. We've heard the pattern in Joseph's story before of how he's lost his clothes at a couple of occasions, and that signaled disaster for him. But here he's putting on some clothes, so maybe his life is going in a different direction. Pharaoh said to Joseph, I have dreamt a dream, and there is no interpreter for it. But I've heard it said of you that you need to hear a dream in order to interpret it. Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, Not I. God will answer what is for Pharaoh's welfare. This is the middle of the chapter, and it's the heart of Joseph's confession. Not I, it's God who will answer. This Hebrew nobody is coming before the king of the empire and saying, I know you don't know, but I don't know either, but God knows, and God will tell me. So he goes on and says, tell me your dream. So Pharaoh spoke to Joseph, reading on now from verse 17. And one of the things to hear in this section is, we've already heard what Pharaoh's dreams were. We heard that he had a dream and he woke up. You know how you've had bad dreams and you wake up. Sometimes you're not even sure what the dream was, but because you're going to have a bad dream, you wake up just before it. But Pharaoh gives even more details to Joseph in this next section. And one of the things he shows is what a terrific responsibility kings of the ancient world had, and what they felt, what a burden they felt towards their people. They were understood to have a special connection to divinity. They were often called the sons of God. But they also had a special responsibility to the people. And we can see that actually reflected in the scriptures about the Jewish kings, such as David and Solomon and all the ones who came after. If you turn to Psalm 27, excuse me, 72, I just got my numbers flipped, Psalm 72. The caption says this is of Solomon. So this is a psalm written to bless Solomon, perhaps at his installation, coronation as king or some other time. And the prayer for him is, in verses 1 through 4, somebody want to read 1 through 4 for us? Again, in a Solomonic voice, or in a voice to praise Solomon. Let's hear verses 1 through 4 of Psalm 72.
Give the king thy justice, O God, and thy righteousness to the royal son. May he judge thy people with righteousness, and thy poor with justice. Let the mountains bear prosperity for the people, and the hills in righteousness. May he defend the cause of the poor of the people. Give deliverance to the needy, and crush the oppressor.
That sums it up right there, and it will also repeat that throughout this psalm, interspersed with high praise. You see, the job description of the king of Israel was to act with God's righteousness and judgment. Those are characters of following the Torah, following God's law, and not departing from it. And prosperity for the people, somehow to ensure that there will be plenty for people to eat, and to have special concern for the poor and the needy. Crush the oppressor, give deliverance to the needy. And those themes continue throughout. So it was a big responsibility. And we're going to hear how Pharaoh, now in verses 17 and a few ones following, how he feels this responsibility towards his people. As Joseph interprets his dreams, and then he kind of panics and tries to figure out what he's going to do. Of course, pharaohs don't panic publicly. They just sort of panic privately and then quick make a move to do something about it. So, starting at verse 17 in chapter 41 of Genesis, Pharaoh spoke to Joseph. In my dream, here I was standing on the bank of the Nile, and here out of the Nile were coming up seven cows, fat of flesh and fair of form, and they grazed in the reed grass. And here seven other cows were coming up after them, wretched and exceedingly ill of form and lank of flesh. In all of the land of Egypt I've never seen their like for ill condition. Then the seven lank and ill-looking cows ate up the first seven cows, the fat ones. They entered their body, but you wouldn't know they'd entered their body, for they were as ill-looking as at the beginning. Then I awoke. And I saw again in my dream, here seven ears were going up on a single stalk, full and good, and here seven ears, hardened, lean, and scorched by the east wind, were springing up after them. Then the lean ears swallowed up the seven good ones. Now I've spoken with the magicians, but there's no one that can tell me the answer. Well, Joseph doesn't miss a beat. He goes on and says, Joseph said to Pharaoh, Pharaoh's dream is one. What God is about to do, he has told Pharaoh. The seven good cows are 7 years. The seven good ears are 7 years. The dream is one. And the seven lank and ill-looking cows that were coming up after them are 7 years. And the 7 years hollow and scorched by the east wind will be 7 years of famine. That is the word that I spoke to Pharaoh. What God is about to do, he has let Pharaoh see. Here, 7 years are coming of great abundance in all the land of Egypt, but 7 years of famine will arise after them, when all the abundance in the land of Egypt will be forgotten. An interesting word given Joseph's story, where people keep forgetting him and remembering him and forgetting him and remembering here. Now, he says it's even going to apply to the world of agriculture. The abundance will be forgotten. The famine will destroy the land, and you will not know of that abundance in the land because of the famine afterward, for it will be exceedingly heavy. Now, as for the twofold repetition of the dream to Pharaoh, it means that the matter is determined by God, and God is hastening to do it. So there's not a thing about this foreign king's dream that Joseph doesn't understand, because God gives him the interpretation. So having interpreted the dream, now, with Pharaoh standing there going, Joseph just goes on with some advice. He gives counsel to the king of Egypt, coming right out of the prison to giving advice to the king of Egypt. So now, let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh do this. Let him appointed overseers for the land, dividing the land of Egypt into five parts during the 7 years of abundance. Let them collect all kinds of food from these good years that are coming, and let them pile up grain under Pharaoh's hand as food provisions in the cities, and keep it under guard. So the provisions will be an appointed reserve for the land for the 7 years of famine that will occur in the land of Egypt, so that the land will not be cut off by the famine. These words, continuing with verse 37, seemed good in Pharaoh's eyes and in the eyes of all his servants. And Pharaoh said to his servants, "Could we find another man like him, a man in whom is the spirit of a god?" Do you think Joseph was nominating himself when he said, "Let Pharaoh select a wise and discerning man"?
Certainly.
Certainly. And Pharaoh has leaped to that. Could we find another like him, a man in whom is the spirit of a god? Now, the Egyptians serve many gods. He has at least accepted from Joseph's mouth that some god that Joseph is in contact with has given Joseph this insight and is worth paying attention to. It's interesting, too, that the word that Joseph uses for God here is a generic term for God. It's like he's saying, like, you know, the divinity has told me. God has told me. If you're ever preparing a prayer for a public setting, you sweat over whether you should conclude it through Jesus Christ our Lord or not, because we know that Jesus Christ is particular to our faith and that not everyone in the gathering will be comfortable with Jesus' name being mentioned. Joseph could have used the divine name of God given that's used in other places in the story, that's given to us in your translation as the Lord in all capital letters. That's in this Hebrew one is represented as YHWH. It's the four letters of the divine name of God actually given to Moses in the burning bush. Now this story happens way before the story of the burning bush, but that name for God is used from the very beginning of Genesis, from Genesis chapter 2 on. And so the whole story has been retold using that particular name of God. But in this encounter with Pharaoh, Joseph doesn't use that particular name of God. He uses a generic name. And Pharaoh can go along with it. So Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since a God has made you know all this, and there's none as wise and discerning as you, you shall be the one over my house. To your orders shall all my people submit. Only by the throne will I be greater than you." And now Joseph is the one who doesn't have any words, so Pharaoh just charges ahead. Pharaoh said further to Joseph, "See, I place you over all the land of Egypt." This is now he's actually doing it. This is like knighting him. And it's the performative word that makes him in charge. And Pharaoh removed his signet ring from his hand and placed it on Joseph's hand. He had him clothed in linen garments and put the gold chain upon his neck. He had him mount the chariot of his second in rank. It's Air Force Two. And they called out before him, "Avrek, attention." Thus he placed him over all the land of Egypt. Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I am Pharaoh, but without you, no man shall raise hand or foot in all the land of Egypt." Pharaoh called Joseph's name, Tzafenat Paneah, the God speaks and he lives. He gave him Asenath, daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, as a wife. And Joseph's influence went out over all the land of Egypt. Now Joseph was 30 years old when he stood in the presence of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Joseph went out from Pharaoh's presence and passed through all the land of Egypt. He's made it to the top. He's accepted as one of the Egyptians.
It only took 13 years.
And it only took 13 years. And most of that spent
in the dungeon.
In the dungeon, yeah. At least, yeah. So now, let's hurry on in this chapter to Joseph at his duties and how he's going to prevent the famine. This is from verses 47 to 57, with an interlude in the middle where he names his sons. He has some sons, and he names his sons. And the Jewish scholar Aviva Zornberg tells us that how Joseph names his sons gives us access to his thoughts about his own life. I mean, he's just been swept up in this current into this high position and taking responsibility because of his wisdom and discernment. But maybe in the names of his children, he's showing kind of what it's like for him to have all of this happen to him. I'll give you more of her thoughts when we come to their names. Verse 47, in the 7 years of abundance, the land produced in handfuls. Now, the thought of that is that you should picture hands reaping and putting things together and gathering them. It doesn't mean there wasn't very much, there were only handfuls rather than bushels full. It means you got to see the people picking and picking and picking. There was so much, they just kept picking. And he collected all kinds of provisions from those 7 years that occurred in the land of Egypt and placed provisions in the cities. The provisions from the fields of a city surrounding it, he placed in it as well. So Yosef piled up grain like the sand of the sea, which reminds us a little bit of God's promise to Abraham about his descendants, as many as the sands of the sea or the stars of the sky. And so in a way, this is saying this is God's faithfulness at work. It's also just giving us a staggering impression of how much food was collected. Exceedingly much, until they had to stop counting, for it was uncountable. Now, two sons were born to Yosef before the year of famine came. It was actually deemed prudent not to have sex during times of famine because you would not be able to safely bear a child to term. And so this tells us Joseph was observing that kind of prudent wisdom. He was wise in every way. Before the year of famine, two sons were born to Yosef, whom Asenath, daughter of Potiphar, a priest of On, bore to him. Yosef called the name of the firstborn Menash, he who makes forget, meaning God has made me forget all my hardships, all my father's house. Aviva Zornberg says, this is a sign that Joseph knew he had to focus on the mission ahead, and he let the birth of his son comfort him in some way so that he put behind him all of his worried thoughts about his family, all of his resentment he may still have had toward his brothers, and he just began to look to the future of his own child and the future of Egypt and the future of whomever else he would be able to help. And the name of the second he called Ephraim, double fruit, meaning God has made me bear fruit in the land of my affliction. Zornberg says, well, that's Joseph's story, isn't it? It's always affliction and blessing at the same time. It's a double fruit. And it's not just, you know, cherries and peaches. It's cherries and bitterness. But it's fruit. And it's a kind of that paradoxical place where we live life in the middle of joys and sorrows, in the middle of ups and downs. And it's a blessing from God.
Is that the dual form in Hebrew?
Ephraim?
Yeah. That's not the dual form?
I don't remember.
I was thinking Shanayim. We know Shanayim is dual.
Yeah, of a noun. Yeah. You know, I'd have to go review that. My Hebrew is rusty, so I kind of know what I've just looked at again recently, and I don't always remember. There came to an end the 7 years of abundance that had occurred in the land of Egypt. And there started to come the 7 years of famine, as Yosef had said. Famine occurred in all lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. But when all the land of Egypt felt the famine, and the people cried out to Pharaoh for bread, Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, go to Yosef, whatever he says to you, do. Now the famine was over all the surface of the earth. Yosef opened up all storehouses in which there was grain and gave out rations to the Egyptians, since the famine was becoming stronger in the land of Egypt. And all lands came to Egypt to buy rations to Yosef, for the famine was strong in all lands. That section there repeats all very often, just to let you know that It was all over. This was a totalizing situation. It was terrible, and yet, because of Joseph, Egypt offered salvation to the people. However, did you notice they sold grain to the countries that came from around there? And in fact, they are selling grain to the Egyptians as well. It didn't come free. I think I had the impression in Sunday school always that Joseph put it all in granaries and then he distributed it all. And so people just could take advantage of the big barns Joseph was able to build, and they got what they needed. But that's not the case, as we see in chapter 47, where we'll go next. But right now, do you have any comments or any reactions to this, to what we've read so far? And do you think that this is, does this give us any suggestions for how we might deal with the food crisis that is impending upon us?
Are we supposed to believe this was unholy or wrong?
That
to sell it back?
To sell it back?
Yeah. I mean, we, several thousand years
next.
Later.
Don't talk about the sale of it now. I was looking ahead, and right now, just go with the what we have in this chapter. Yeah. And
well, I got the impression, perhaps, that initially they sold it to the people, but after a while, once the money is gone, then it had to be given.
Oh, yeah, it's worse than that.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll go there next.
Well, one element regarding this that doesn't quite seem to fit the scenario, which is Joseph knowing ahead there's going to be this series of seven. So our current life situation, I mean the current situation, if the famine is already beginning, as implied by the articles that you read, we are not aware of somebody that was given that warning, and we as a people, as a society, as humanity, didn't take the wisdom of Joseph to heart and start preparing for it.
Well, why would we think that this was news was broadcast? I mean, to me, this could look like insider trading.
Yeah. And then, of course, the other question that we pose ourselves is, as a worldwide society, have we indeed gotten those warnings from a 20th century, 21st century Joseph, and we don't have a Pharaoh that listened? Huh?
Haven't you been storing up?
No. Okay, I admit. that's kind of an interesting parallel. And of course, one of the things that flows out of that in terms of reflecting this passage to our current time, which is a concerted effort on the part of leadership to deny predictions on the part of people that said we've got a shift in climate, and a resulting thing, you don't know what you're talking about. I don't have a PhD in climatology, but you don't know what you're talking about. 70% of the people that study it say it, but just a whole bunch of perhaps leadership that wasn't as insightful as Pharaoh to listen to somebody that said, this may be coming.
Right. Yeah.
Maybe this is just my own personal issue, but 40 years ago, birth control was considered an essential element in our care of the world. And it seems like now you don't hear that. And that's why I picked up on what you said, that was considered something you would do if famine came along. And almost nowhere do you hear that anymore, just as though it's anathema to mention.
Well, we berated the Chinese for it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's
right.
Always held up as, wow, look how bad these people are, look what they do.
One child policy.
Yeah.
Isn't there something that our government said about teaching birth control was they wouldn't do if you would, somewhere this clicked in, that that was not to be taught if they were going to get...
If they want our funding.
Right.
Oh, yes.
And actually, birth control is, was advocated, which is abstinence only.
Right, that's the administrative position.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, you might as well spit in the wind on that.
Yeah. And we know how successful that's been.
In our country as well as around the world.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And in fighting AIDS. Yeah, it's really successful. So, I saw him. Yeah.
Well, so much of the world is Catholic anyhow, the third world countries that, you know, are against birth control. So, it is kind of a struggle to...
But Italy has the lowest birth, has the lowest birth rate in the developed world, so clearly they're not paying that much attention to the Pope.
Yeah. I was thinking of South America mainly.
Yeah.
Well, I want to take you to chapter 47, just for a little behind the scenes understanding of how Joseph pulled this off. The question here is whether this is an ethical crisis. Is Joseph true to the God of Israel in how he is managing this crisis, given this? Is he finding the delicate boundary between resistance and accommodation? Is he bringing the resource of his belief in God, his faith in God, and his knowledge of God to bear in a way that is true to who God is? So, chapter 47, verses 13 to 26. But bread there was none in all the land, for the famine was exceedingly heavy, and the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan were exhausted by the famine. Joseph had collected all the silver that was to be found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan from the rations that they had bought. And Joseph had brought the silver into Pharaoh's house. When the silver in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan had run out, all the Egyptians came to Joseph saying, "Come now, let us have bread. Why should we die in front of you because the silver is gone?" Joseph said, "Come now, let me have your livestock, and I will give you bread in exchange for your livestock, since the silver is gone." So they brought their livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them bread in exchange for the horses, the sheep livestock, the oxen livestock, and the asses. He got them through with bread in exchange for all their livestock in that year. But when that year had run out, they came back to him in the second year and said to him, "We cannot hide from my lord that if the silver has run out and the animal stocks are my lord's, nothing remains for my lord except for our bodies and our soil. Why should we die before your eyes, so we, so our soil? Acquire us and our soil for bread, and we and our soil will become servants to Pharaoh. They are willing to be sharecroppers. They're willing to be indentured servants. Give us seed for sowing that we may live and not die, that the soil may not become desolate." So Joseph acquired all the soil of Egypt for Pharaoh. For each of the Egyptians sold his field, for the famine was strong upon them, and the land went over to Pharaoh. As for the people, he transferred them into the cities from one edge of Egypt's border to its other edge. They don't have any farms to live on anymore. Only the soil of the priests he did not acquire, for the priests had a prescribed allocation from Pharaoh, and they ate from their allocation which Pharaoh had given them. Therefore, they did not sell their soil. Joseph said to the people, "Now that I have acquired you and your soil today for Pharaoh, here you shall have seed. Sow the soil. But it shall be at the ingatherings that you shall give a fifth to Pharaoh." This is a 20% tax. "The four other parts being for you as seed for the field and for your eating needs, for those in your households and for feeding your little ones." They said, "You have saved our lives. May we find favor in my lord's eyes. We will become servants to Pharaoh." And Joseph made it a prescribed law until this day concerning the soil of Egypt, for Pharaoh every fifth part. Only the soil of the priests, that alone did not go over to Pharaoh. This could be a matter of fact reporting without any judgment involved. This is what happened under these dire circumstances. The people, in fact, thank Pharaoh. But there's another point of view on it, which is that this is pretty drastic, and these were desperate people, and they were thanking Pharaoh for taking everything from them and turning them into sharecroppers and slaves. Maybe it takes our eyes to see that, but I don't think so. I think that it took the eyes of Hebrew people to see that. And when this story was told in Hebrew circles, I wonder if there isn't some irony in telling this story, if there isn't some subtle critique. Because it's a good story, and yet, you know what this means? This means that Joseph is actually, because he's so identified with Pharaoh and Pharaoh's policies, Joseph is actually part of the reason that the people of Israel and other people became slaves in Egypt.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So is Joseph...
That doesn't come through in the Bible stories that we learn.
No, it doesn't come through in the Bible stories that we learn.
If there was a famine, there must have been a drought. How in the world could they have been given seed and plant anything if there was a drought, except along the river?
Well, it would be along the river that this was happening. I don't know
if they'd get water from the river.
They had irrigation systems, too. And actually, there is a point of view that says, you know, Egypt had granaries long before any Hebrew people were there. But when the first Hebrews came down to Egypt and saw that, they would have been impressed with that very different way of living than the way that they lived, which was to follow their sheep and goats from place to place and with the water that they could find in the wilderness. So Egypt was like a whole different world. And to have this story that one of theirs, Joseph, was the one who invented the system, I mean, why, that's claiming quite a bit. And it's a grand thing. And maybe it was that way and maybe it wasn't that way, well, historically.
I was thinking of, I think it was Menachem Begin said to Anwar Sadat, pointing to the...
the Aswan Dam.
And saying, no, it was the...
Pointing to...
No, sorry. You go to Egypt, the pyramids. He said, look, we built those for you.
Yeah.
And Sadat's like, yeah, right. but the inconsistency here that particularly struck me is, when there is no grain, you don't have... you don't have cattle, you don't have horses, that's nuts.
Yeah, the animals would go first.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So.
So maybe there, it's not, I don't know.
So maybe there is an economic critique in this story, and it's sort of showing how, in the Hebrew sense, you give up your animals, you give up your land, you give up everything, it's a pretty bad situation. Yet, Joseph is a hero. We don't want to, I mean, he's going to say to his brothers, you know, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good, and I was able to bring life to all these people. So it's a tough and realistic situation. It raises for us questions of, like, you know, should we send all of our American-grown aid to other places? Is that the best way to feed the world? It's kind of a centralized distribution center, kind of like the Egyptians had going here. Or would it make more sense to buy in Africa and buy in other places? Would that be good for us? Can we afford to be that generous to the Africans?
I was thinking of a meeting I had gone to in, you know, groups of people from various churches, and one of them said, oh, we're helping a village that is suffering terribly from drought. We're buying them a cow. And would you like to help? And I'm going, who buys a cow for people who are experiencing drought? That's insane. And... but we were too polite to say that, of course. Which is...
And you don't know either if that accurately represents the situation, or maybe there is water, but they think that saying there's a drought will pull your heartstrings or something. I mean, unless you're on the ground, you can't...
My feelings were just, these people have no idea what they were... They were not going through any agency.
Uh-huh.
They had decided as a church,
uh-huh,
we're going to adopt this village and this is what we're going to do from them. And what they seemed to know about it was there was a drought. And it's like a cow drinks more water than it produces in milk. Well, who would buy a cow anyway? You'd buy them a goat.
Right.
It was
right, or a pig or something like that. So,
Can I say one more thing? Jews had no responsibility to people who were not Jewish. I mean, you get that in other pieces of the Bible. And I've been told that by rabbis.
I don't think that's true of the Old Testament vision, the Hebrew scripture vision of Jewish responsibility, because Abraham, as part of his call, was blessed to be a blessing to all the nations. And part of God's ongoing frustration with Israel is that they never got it through their thick skulls, that they weren't there just for themselves, but they were there to bless the nations.
Yeah, and I don't remember which chapter in Isaiah, but Isaiah says, God said, I'm putting you there, Israel, to tell the world about me,
right.
Not to hold on. And he didn't use those words, but the statement is, I'm putting you there because to tell the world about me.
Tell the world about me, and all the nations will come.
All the nations, that, you know, your responsibility is to tell the world.
Even the exile, that terrible, terrible being cast into the pit as they experienced it, was reframed by some prophets as, well, now you can be a light to the nations because God has driven you into the nations. You're going to finally have to do what God puts you on earth to do.
I think there's the part, and I forgot exactly where it is. For one thing, there's the part about, if someone has to become your slave, and debts are forgiven after 7 years, but only to Jews, not to people who are
and
not
at
Jews.
The same time, in those laws, it says, remember the sojourner, for you were a sojourner in Egypt. What we want to say, I think, is that Scripture is not monolithic, but there are different voices competing for airtime within Scripture. And the question for us is which ones we will hear and let shape us, and which ones are maybe closest to the dream of God.
I was sitting God in on a Torah study, and this is where it came up. And it was being discussed, and the rabbi came in and talked
thank
us
you,
about it.
And I
okay,
understand.
Okay, I'll drop it.
No,
okay.
Thank you, and I understand that Jewish tradition may have taken it that way. But what's happened is in the early, when we've got the Hebrew scriptures, and then as a result of living through the Hebrew scriptures, Christianity took one path and Rabbinic Judaism took another path. Both are legitimate responses to what is in the Old Testament scriptures. But Rabbinic Judaism and Christianity are different responses to the Hebrew scriptures. Different trajectories that come out of the Hebrew scriptures. And so a rabbi may very well say that and it will make perfect sense within the context of Rabbinic Judaism, but I'm saying it does not make perfect sense within the context of Christianity and the way we appropriate the scriptures through Jesus, who was one of the least and lost and dead, who rose again, whose message was intended to be a blessing to the whole world, which is a theme that they picked out of the Hebrew scriptures. So I'm going to disagree respectfully with that rabbi. And at the same time, I want to know more about how the rabbi sees it, because I can learn things from that too. Lee?
One thing that I reflect upon, because we're talking about this story and whether it was an economic statement, knowing what eventually develops in Hebrew law about Sabbath year and Jubilee, one wonders if this is the way that where the lesson was learned that says nature and humanity, the way we are, what will happen continuously in economics, in environment, and in people's relationship with each other, is the wealth will migrate and accumulate to the select few. And we know that the response to that from a people that are listening to the word of God and responding to God's message says, that's not right. And so periodically, we have to overcome this through our actions and recognize, and ultimately what this leads to is recognizing that, and it's difficult because we all fall into it, recognizing that, guess what, none of this is ours. Pharaoh does not own this. All of this is God's. And the mistake that we have, and it permeates Christian theology and Christian behavior,
which is we always say, I'm going to give one-tenth of my possessions
my
to God.
Possessions. Yeah.
Of my possessions to God. Mm-hmm. And that is theologically inaccurate.
Yeah, because everything belongs to God.
That's right. So what we've done in our theology is, in our theology, and especially the theology of America, is the belief that we own this, and that is exactly opposite of what our theology should be telling
right.
us.
Right, and so that phrase from Brueggemann about finding the delicate boundary between resistance and accommodation mm-hmm. is one that's incumbent on all of us. Mm-hmm. What in these economic times, in this world situation, what can we go along with and what do we need to resist because of the values of our faith in our God? So, ongoing question, and it may keep us honest and alert and on our feet to think about things like that. Brueggemann, a very strange thing happens in the memory of Israel. In the book of Genesis, things are clear and sequenced about our ancestors. In Genesis 12-24, Abraham with Sarah. Genesis 25-26, Isaac with Rebecca. Genesis 27-36, Jacob with Rachel. And Genesis 37-50, Joseph. Four generations of promise. But then Israel reduced this long narrative to a mantra. It comes out in the long form, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, or in the short form, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It's astonishing that in neither long nor short form does anybody ever say the God of Joseph. The guy in the fourth generation of Israel's memory drops out of the mantra. I'm going to talk about that dropout and invite you to listen carefully, because while I talk about Joseph, I may not be talking about him at all, but about someone closer to our own time and place, Brueggemann says. And then he suggests this is where Joseph can be criticized, or how Joseph might have lived differently if he had not completely been subsumed by his Egyptian identity. He might have countered Pharaoh's nightmare with Israel's promise, had he cherished his rootage more. He might have invited Pharaoh out of his phantom of scarcity with the abundance of the land-giving God of Israel. Clearly, however, he holds the old Israelite promises and the old Yahwistic abundance loosely, perhaps thinking such old cadences weak and embarrassing in the environment of the growth economy of Pharaoh. As a consequence, he never utters a word about his own identity, giving himself over completely to Pharaoh's defining nightmare, so compliant to it that he himself might have had disturbing nightmares of scarcity, enacting imperial power by day and imperial threat by night. I think he is in the end dropped from Israel's theological summary because Israel was unclear about Joseph's God. Israel might confess the God of Joseph, who then turned out to be the Egyptian author of slavery. Joseph had to be dropped because he understood so little and valued so thinly the God of the promise that he served greedy interests that victimized his own people. So that's what I like about these stories. They don't move in one clear direction, but they give us plenty to talk about and chew on and think about, and they also hold up mirrors and suggestions and prods and challenges to ourselves. Tomorrow we're going to see Joseph and his brothers interact and reconcile. Peace to the family of Jacob at last. So come back if you can, please.
Thank you.